Our second reading is from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8, starting at verse 27. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on his way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" They answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." He asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said this all quite openly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with the disciples and said, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who want to lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in glory of his fathers with the holy angels." The word of the Lord. Sometimes I don't know why the lectionary puts two texts together. They just do, and I don't understand why. But today, for our Old and New Testament texts, I am so taken with their pairing. To me, they feel like old friends being reintroduced by new experiences, or perhaps two different dishes mixed together with just a different ingredient, a new pairing, if you will. I'm so intrigued by the insights that we get from the Gospel of Mark, which is often called the first passion prediction, with our well-known text from Genesis about Abraham and Sarah, their name change, and God's wonderful covenant promise to them. I am awestruck by this covenant that travels the span of time from biblical days all the way to us. But this covenant that does not change, it travels, but it does not change. The Mark text, as we read, brings us dramatically into the second week of Lent. We remember back about a month what began on those sunny seas of Galilee when Jesus first summons those followers to follow me, now all takes place within the shadow of the cross. We're offered three centering questions. Maybe you'll think about these. Who do you believe Jesus to be? What does it mean for you for Jesus to be called the Christ, the Son of God, the Messiah? And looking at your own life, what does it mean to be a disciple? These are all weighty and woven questions, questions that I believe are closely linked to the pairing of God's call on each of our lives and God's everlasting covenant with all of the creatures of the world, even those red worms. From earlier in Genesis, we remember God's call to both who we call Abram and Sarai. Go from your country and your family and your father's house and go to a land that I will show you. I will make your name great. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you, and you will be a blessing. So with that promise, and only that promise, and faith in God, Abram and Sarah, they take off from what they had known, from some level of security, off into a violent an insecure world. Genesis reports to us that their wealth grows, indicating God's blessings, but what they really wanted, a child, there's no sign in Sarah's womb. I believe that they're at this place of heartbreak, a place of empty longing, a place at some point or another in our lives we can all relate to. By the time we reach chapter 17, our text today, both Abram and Sarah have been pushed to the limit. They've made those horrendous decisions. You remember with Hagar, the woman they abuse, and their shared child, Ishmael. Sarah is still barren. They're both about 99 years old with no realistic expectations of having a child. They're lost. But then we know, as it feels when nothing is going to happen, God speaks. I am the God Almighty, God says, or in Hebrew, El Shaddai, that we sometimes sing about. I'm the God of the mountain. This is about the God of absolute power. And God addresses both of them in the imperative. Walk before me, be blameless. And I will make a covenant between me and you, and I will make your descendants exceedingly numerous. It's no suggestion. There's no negotiation. It's not if then, I will. It's God's command to Abram, and I believe both to Sarah as well. They don't even really get to nod their head. They just expected that they will follow. And they do. They keep on following, even when there seems to be no hope, because God has given them hope. We see parallels in Jesus' calling of the disciples from that first follow me, when they leave their nets, their whole livelihoods, even their families, to when Jesus calls Levi the tax collector, he leaves what was a relatively secure life, to this calling in this story to these disciples, to always follow. It isn't really about the people, though, which is surprising. I usually think it's about the people of the story. But throughout the whole span of the biblical story, it's more about something much more. It's about the God of absolute authority. This is the God who sees us as we really are, sees us in our deepest longings, and both calls and commands us to follow. This covenant is God's radical and unconditional bond, where Abraham and all of his descendants, us included, are forever sealed into God's wonderful and new creation. God only creates good things, and God has created us. This is the covenant that's extended to all people through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that's why we're here today, isn't it? So who do you believe Jesus to be? How does belief in God, what does it mean for you as you seek to be a disciple of Jesus Christ? One of my favorite books, just published a couple years ago, is called Speaking Christian. It's by Marcus Borg, who died this past year. It's written for Christians like us who live in a pluralistic world, so many different thoughts, processes, what does it mean to be a Christian, what is faith, what is belief, so much coming to us from so many different angles. In this book, Borg breaks down what does it mean for as biblical faith versus what the rest of the world is teaching us. For example, when we think about faith, we often think of it as a sense of beliefs, things that we can choose to believe in or not. Some things that we believe in depending on our mood or our stage of life. For example, I have faith in my family. They have, for more or less, always been present to me. They've always listened to my concerns, helped me in times of struggle. I have faith in them because they have done things. But I can also choose not to have faith in them. I can choose that we do disagree on some things, and I can go another way. In the same way, I have faith that you will show up on Sundays. you have proven yourself as such. I have faith that you will volunteer in the things of this church. I have faith that we will be a community together. But in a season of life, I can choose not to believe in this, not to believe in you. I can choose that. And there are so many things much less deep than faith and church that we can choose whether we believe or not, some intricate parts of the faith. We believe then in that kind of thing, that it's a faith that begins with us. Like we believe it begins with those disciples. But being here is so much more than being about us. This is a faith that doesn't begin with us, which is weird to understand, but begins with God. Covenant faith begins with God, not with us. It is God's invitation to Abraham and Sarah, and not the other way around. In those ancient biblical days, faith meant utter reliance on God. It was about survival. I bet it is the same for some of us. Some of us in war-torn parts of the world. Borg says this kind of faith is what we call in Old English to beloef, B-E-L-O-E-F, or to hold dear. This is what we call to belove. I love this phrase. It's highlighted in Jesus' words for us. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind and all your strength. Those words come earlier in Mark. And then we hear, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. These are hard words. It's a hard season of Lent. They hearken to the often quoted words from Dietrich Bonhoeffer in The Cost of Discipleship. When Jesus calls a man or woman, Jesus bids this person to come and die. In these words from Jesus to Peter, we hear a threefold condition of discipleship. Number one, to deny yourself. Number two, to take up your cross. And number three, to follow Jesus. But the third, to follow Jesus, is dependent on the first two, denying yourself and taking up your cross. It's the opposite message that we're often given in life. I don't know about you, but I've always heard, be successful. Study hard so you can get into the best college, so you can get into the best job, so you can make a good living, so you can support your family, so you can be powerful, I guess, so you can be comfortable. Be successful, work hard so you'll be promoted. And with the extra time you have, give back to charity, give back to the church. But only do that if you have extra time. Obviously, you all have heard a different message. You're here today. Being a disciple of Jesus, as you well know, takes on an entirely different focus. Sometimes we think this focus all has to do with giving up everything, all the worldly pleasures. And some of us are called into radical Christian poverty. The hard thing I've noticed, though, is we're at the risk when we deny all of our worldly treasures. We start worshiping the idea of giving up all of these things rather than worshiping God, God's self. Or more dangerously, sometimes we think that it's God's will that we suffer. Women have often suffered because of this thought throughout the spans of time. We've made people who are minority groups, people with less power, suffer because of this. Christians have made other Christians suffer. And people have believed that it is their will, God's will, that we suffer, or some people suffer. But we know that can't be true. That's about people's will, not about God's. Rather, God is calling us to a denial of self that grasps after things for one's own benefit. That kind of self that makes those little cutting remarks, I do them. The judgmental self, the self that judges both ourselves and our neighbor, the self that's beholden to anger, even justified anger. The self's obsessed with image and power and beauty. The self that believes that we are on the center of the stage, that we are the protagonist in the story. To deny this kind of self-serving, self-grasping self is to liberate the true self that's at the center of each of us. This is the center where we, each of us, believes that we, you, I, those we have met and those we haven't met, are all beloved, all creatures of God, created good. This is the dying to the old and rising to the new. We learn about who we are by discovering who God is. And we do this together in covenant community. So I end with these slightly strange thoughts about worms. I have never seen worms in worship, perhaps you haven't either, or compost for that matter. But I was so inspired by our series on food and faith. It made me think that every part of our lives needs to be centered to our faith. Even the simple task or gift of eating. We are called to pay attention to every part of our lives and how every part of our lives has to do with God and can be an act of worshiping God. Together, we come together on Sundays, and some of us throughout the rest of the week, to practice worshiping God, to practice being disciples to one another, so we can go out into the world and be disciples, to be the light. My hope is that this Lenten season, we can witness together how God can take what is used up and forgotten and make something brand new. So from now through the summer, hopefully for a while, we can watch as these worms break down the compost, these food scraps, things that we would have thrown away anyway, and how as disciples we can watch how God breathes new life in. Perhaps in the spring we'll take that compost and we'll plant beans, and then early tomatoes, and then big sunflowers even. The worms multiply in that bin. Did you know that? Sometimes they escape even. So we can take those worms home. We can plant our own little garden. This creation-tending garden that started here can bring new life somewhere else. This gracious call of God on each of our lives, both a call and a commandment to follow, to spread the good news of God's love to the earth. My hope is in that in covenant community across generations, so not just the kids, but all of us, can experience God's covenant. This covenant that began with Abraham and Sarah, extended to all of us through Jesus Christ. This message of resurrection, this Easter message, that we prepare for in Lent is the message that we as city dwellers are to shout everywhere, perhaps on our mountaintops if we go hiking, or on top of high-rise buildings, or on top of highway overpasses, or perhaps even in a rooftop garden that started with the compost from those worms. Everything is a gift of life. Everything is part of this covenant. In every way, we are called to be disciples. Amen.